The Native American Youth and Family Center, 5135 Northeast Columbia Boulevard, Portland, Oregon. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meetings policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Finance Committee meets the fourth Monday of every month at 4:30 p.m.
Hi, everyone. This is Dan Johnson, and you're listening to Between the Covers. And my guest today is the author, Mr. Craig Johnson. He is the author of best-selling series of mystery westerns based on the character Sheriff Walt Longmire. Boy, I kept telling myself, I'm not going to say Langmire. I'm going to say Longmire. So, oh, well, I got that out of my system now. So, okay, Craig is the author of 13 novels in the Walt Longmire mystery series, which has garnered popular and critical acclaim. The Walt Longmire series was originally seen on A&E, but is now on Netflix. And I've seen quite a few of them, and they're great reads. The books are really good. Okay, one other thing of note that you need to know about is that Craig lives with his wife Judy on a ranch in Ucross, Wyoming. And I don't think I've ever been to Ucross. Well, I flew over Wyoming once.
Not too many people have, with a population of 25. We're kind of out of the way.
And you don't really have traffic problems.
No, we don't. Nothing like Portland, I can tell you that much.
Well, welcome back to KBOO. It's great to know that you were here once and you said, well, they didn't scare me off. So
this is my kind of place, actually.
You betcha. I mentioned in my intro that your books are Western mysteries as compared to just generic mysteries. Do you find exception with that?
No, not at all. Again, I mean, I think, you know, it's a great quote by Studs Terkel, where nothing ever happened nowhere. And so for me, it's kind of an essential aspect of the books and the characters that they do take place, you know, in the American High Plains in the West. And it's a very specific portion of the High Plains there in Wyoming. And I think that informs an awful lot of the book, a lot of the characters, the relationships, you know, the sociology, the spirituality. The books are right there on the borders of the Northern Cheyenne and the Crow Reservation. And so there's a lot of things that are permanently and indelibly tied to the West. And I would be silly, you know, to abandon that or move away from it.
Right. Okay. I'm going to have you read a couple of different sections, as we mentioned off air.
Mm-hmm.
And before we get into that, I want you to tell us, your latest book is called Western Star.
Uh-huh.
What's it all about?
Well, I write a series of books about the sheriff of the least populated county in the least populated state in America, and that would be Wyoming. And in this particular book, my protagonist happens to be down in Douglas at the Law Enforcement Academy in Wyoming, where he's doing a recertification for weapons one of the things that they do whenever they finish up is they head over to the Labonte Hotel and have a drink, you know, in celebration after you recertify. And so all of the sheriffs head over there and of course Walt's one of the older sheriffs. And he's standing there, and all of a sudden, Joe Ironcloud, one of the other sheriffs from Washakie County, comes over and says, looks over Walt's right shoulder and sees a photograph. It's an old photograph of an 844 Northern locomotive, the very last steam locomotive used by any rail line, major rail line in the United States, and never retired like that. Actually, they still use them today, you know, for all of these junkets out of
There was a Western UP. Star Railroad?
Actually, it's not the Western Star Railroad. It's just the locomotive itself. itself like that. But what happens is that, you know, in the front of this locomotive, there are 25 armed men standing there with their light-colored hats on and their gun belts. Look at it, and Joe Ironclad looks at the photograph and says, "Is that you on the end?" And Walt turns around and looks and says, "Yeah, that's me. That's from 1972. I'd just come back from Vietnam," like that, and Lucian had hired me, and he brought me along on the Western Star. And the premise of the book is that from 1948 to 1972, the Wyoming Sheriff's Association had its annual meeting on a train that ran from Cheyenne to Evanston and back. And Joe Ironclad looks at him and says, 24 armed sheriffs on a train. And Walt looks at him and says, "When we started." And of course, as Walt's climbing on board the Western Star, he has a paperback copy of Murder on the Orient Express in his back pocket that falls out. And one of the older sheriffs picks it up and says, "You studying up, you know, youngster?" And he says, no, I just, you know, since I got back from the war, I need to have a book in my hands on a general basis." Like it. And he says, "Well, she pretty much had it figured out, didn't she?" And Walt says, "What do you mean?" Like it. And he says, "Well, there's only so many permutations of this. You know, he did it, she did it, they all did it, nobody did it." And he says, "Have you finished that book?" And Walt says, "No." And he says, "Well, we'll talk when you do."
And now that you've said that, if you would open your book
to this page, is starting to sound like a quiz, is what this is starting to
sound
like.
279.
279. Okay, boy, we're on way on down the road here.
Yeah, and okay. Then the paragraph that you're going to see where it says, "I looked at the frozen landscape," right at the top of the page.
Mm-hmm.
Read that paragraph, if you would.
"I looked at the frozen landscape and thought about the body of the one-armed sheriff still lying out there somewhere. Then my eyes dropped to the man at my feet and the paperback lodged under his side, and I thought about what Leland had said, that there were only so many permutations to the whodunit. He did it, she did it, nobody did it, they all did it."
So that word permutations comes back again.
It does.
And it sort of has a bell ringing to it.
It does.
Why don't you explain that?
Well,
don't explain what happens before that, because then you give part of the story away.
Right. I don't know how much I can give. You know, I can talk about without giving a little bit of that away. Like that. There's an instance where the character that we just mentioned, Marv Leland, like that, actually uses the term permutation. Like that. It's kind of one of the shocks for Walt, I think, to a certain extent. You know, because he comes to the realization that, like, you know, thinks that a bum just used the word permutation to him at the railroad depot,
right,
in Cheyenne.
Right.
Like,
couldn't figure that out. I just found that an interesting, here we're talking the plot of how a story is going to unfold and all of the variables that come together to make it happen.
Absolutely. I'm really proud of that. You, like, retained that all the way through from that one of those first scenes there. That's pretty amazing. Good job.
Well, I took my meds that day. Now, if you would turn over to page 19.
Okay.
And, you know, one of the things that they tell us about good writers is that ability to say things well in such a short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And I found one paragraph that you wrote that I thought was well done. Go down to about 2/3 where the paragraph starts, designated UP 844 or 8444.
Designated UP 8444, so as to not be confused with the 844 diesel engine already in service, Wyoming's Western Star was a legend of a bygone era. But at the moment, it was a living, breathing reality, a 907,890-pound behemoth that rolled into my life like a mechanized buffalo, snorting and lumbering destiny in every rotation of its steel.
I've always believed that saying is true, that if you can write in short paragraphs, write a well-written paragraph, mm-hmm. you've got a makings of something really good, and you've done some descriptive work there. I know some people that are, what do they call them, critical, they write critical fiction where they would have taken that paragraph and they would have broken down the diesel engine part by part and what each function was, and they'd have had you asleep before you knew it.
Yeah, I kind of like, you know, I tend to, you know, refer back to Chekhov in a lot of those situations like that. You know, and his statement was that I don't need to know everything that's in the room. I need to know what I need to know is in the room and why it's in the room. And I think that, you know, especially in the modern day, I mean, obviously, you know, writing, you know, more importantly, reading tastes, you know, they actually go through a kind of a metamorphosis, as it were. Like that, I'm rereading Robert Penn Warren's, you know, All the King's Men, like that. And, you know, some of his descriptive passages go on for, you know, for pages like that. And they're luxurious. They're luxuriant like that. But I think most modern readers, you know, would get annoyed, you know, with them after a certain point in time. So I think you got to walk a tightrope and try and do, you know, the language, some, you know, some beauty like that, and use some poetry and some balance to it.
It can take some practice.
It can. Yeah. But I appreciate the idea that brevity is not the worst thing in the world in these situations.
Did you start off writing that way? Was that just a part of the knack that you had?
Yeah, I think so. I think also, like, that it's it was a question of, excuse me, like a question of the, I mean, it's a little bit of a metaphorical aspect of Wyoming itself, in the sense that, you know, Wyoming lends itself to a descriptiveness, but not a lush kind of descriptiveness. I mean, it's a barren landscape to a certain extent, especially on the high plains, and certainly on that section down along I-80 where the majority of this train ride takes place. I have to laugh like that because, you know, whenever I meet some people and they say, you know, well, we've been to Wyoming, and I say, really, you've been to Wyoming? And they go, yes. Look at it. And I'm like, it doesn't all look like I-80, just so you know. Like, I mean, there's some really beautiful parts of Wyoming, but, you know, some of those stretches, you know, along I-80, along the southern portion, you know, where the railroads came through, like that, they tend to be a little bit flat, and you know, that was one of the main reasons why the rail trails went through there, like that, and the main major highway goes through there, like that. But but I think that, you know, in many ways, you know, my descriptive aspects kind of tend to be a little bit mirror images of, you know, because of the way Wyoming is the way it is. Mm-hmm. Like it. And for me, that's enjoyable. Like, I get to try and get that across as much as I possibly can, you know, because when somebody reads the books, I want them to be an expert on Wyoming. I want them to know everything there is to know.
Well, let me ask you, when you first started thinking about writing this series of books, did you think about the fact that they were going to evolve into 12, 13 volume set? And two, how long did Walt Longmire rest in the recesses of your mind before you actually put them on paper?
Walt was there for an awfully long time. I mean, you know, people always ask the question, how did you become a writer? And there are only, you know, two honest answers, you know, to that question. One is that, you know, you stumble onto a story that you think is worth telling, like that maybe, you know, hasn't been told to death. And then the other is that, you know, you finally run out of excuses. You finally get to the point where you sit down and you go, okay, I'm going to do this now. I'm going to sit down and I'm going to write this book. And Walt, you know, had kind of loitered, you know, in my subconscious, you know, for a number of years like that before I finally sit down and put, you know, pen to paper and trying to, you know, turn it into a novel. And the first novel, A Cold Dish, was actually a standalone book. It was not supposed to be a series book at all like that. And then Viking Penguin got a hold of me and said, you know, hey, we think that these characters in this place, you know, people are going to want to know more. And, of course, that's when I, with the knowledge of not even having had one book published, started arguing with the president of Penguin USA and going, oh, I don't think that'll work, but I've got some other ideas I want to bounce off of you. And she said, why don't you go back to your ranch in Wyoming and sit down and think about this? And so I did, you know, and a lot of it came back to me that, you know, yeah, there were a lot more stories that I wanted to hear from these characters. I wanted to know more about them, their backstories, their futures, you know, all of these things like that. And I thought, well, you idiot, nobody else is going to write this, so maybe you better sit down and do it. Like,
I found it interesting in the way you develop your characters. And one of the unique things that I was struck by Henry. And he seems to be a unique individual. And, of course, I think Lou Diamond Phillips does a really good job of him.
He's a remarkable performer.
In that, Henry uses no contractions. Did you design that?
I did. It's actually, I have to admit, you know, that, I mean, one of my favorite quotes is the one from Wallace Stegner where he says, you know, the greatest piece of fiction ever written is the disclaimer at the beginning of every book that says nobody in this book is based off anybody alive or dead. You know, and what a crock that is.
Right.
I mean, you know, and the difficulty for me, of course, is that, you know, I come from a state that only has 500,000 people in it. So whenever I stick people in my books, it doesn't take them very long to figure out who it is that I'm talking about. And it's even worse up on the Northern Cheyenne Reservation because there are only 5,000 enrolled members on the Northern Cheyenne Tribe. And so, you know, I've gotten to the point now where I don't even bother changing the names of the people I stick into my books. But the character of Henry is actually based off of a good friend of mine, Marcus Red Thunder. And a lot of the spirituality, a lot of the humor comes directly from him. Like, and it's a very specific, you know, place and a very specific people and incredible people like that. And to me, it would have been criminal to not include them in a series of Western books, you know, that took place in the contemporary American West.
Right.
I mean, we have few enough ethnicities as it is, you know, on the high plains. And so for me, it was kind of essential, like that they'd be a part of that. And I knew there was going to be a spirituality to the books, but I knew that that spirituality probably wasn't going to be a mainstream white spirituality. Like to put it into context, whenever I'm standing around with my buddies up on the Northern Cheyenne Reservation and I'm standing there talking with Marcus, and I'm fully aware that my kind of people have only been in that part of the world for a couple of hundred years, whereas his people have been there for a couple thousand.
Right, exactly.
And so, you know, I take that into consideration whenever right. they're giving me advice on what I should do and how I should do it.
right. Well, I think one of the things that I've noticed, and I don't want to jump ahead of myself here, but when we come back, we're going to take a slight break. And when we come back, I want to talk about the other book that we have, An Obvious Fact. And there are some issues in there that, not issues. I have some
elements.
There you go. That's the word. But we're going to take a slight break. And so when we return, we'll delve into that one, too.
That sounds great.
All right. We'll be right back. Here's Bruce Hornsby.
lives to what's gone down of the long, tall, cool wood. Looks like a new friend I found. Long, tall, cool wood. Bunny Bell left the Bobby well for the long,
was Bruce Hornsby, and I dug that up from an old CD of mine from I can't remember how many years ago. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Between the Covers. My guest is Craig Johnson, who is the author of the Longmire series. Hey, Craig, did you ever envision that not only would you have a success with the books that you had, but that there would be 13 now, and that it would morph into a TV series?
You know, the only goal that I set out for myself was is that I hoped that I would be able to sell enough books that I could continue writing books. That was the only goal that I set for myself. And it was interesting like that because I think, you know, what happened was is, you know, like I was talking about earlier as far as like trying to do something different. You know, whenever I came up with the idea of Walt, that was a period in time when everything was all kind of CSI. You know, everything was all about, you know, the miracles of DNA, you know, and all of these things like that. Well, in Wyoming, we have one crime lab in the whole state down in Cheyenne, and that can be a very long way away during certain times of the year. And I ran into a couple of DCI investigators, Division of Criminal Investigation investigators, and I you know, asked them, I said, how long does it take you guys to get DNA evidence? You know, and he looked at me and said, is this a high-profile case? And I said, let's pretend like it is. And he goes, about 9 months. And I was like, okay, so what they're doing then in these books and these television shows, that's not particularly honest, is it? And he goes, no, it's not. Like, and so I thought, well, okay, well, what if you did a protagonist, you know, who was in the least populated county, least populated state? It would make you focus more on character and place, like that. And that's usually where the best writing is, in my opinion. I mean, I'm not a Luddite. I'm not, you know, completely anti-technology, like it, or else I wouldn't be on the radio right now, right, Don?
So, yeah. Well, you might be. You could put a radio station out there in Wyoming.
It's true. It's true. There are very many of them, like it, I got to admit.
Just put a stick out there in the middle of the country.
But I think, you know, that was one of the key elements to the whole process, in the sense that, you know, it was a success because I was doing something different than what everybody else was doing. Like, and then, you know, yeah, the TV show, I think it was the same thing. I think that they were looking for something different. And at that point in time, like, you know, we were on basic cable, like, you know, with A&E, like, mm-hmm. But we were the highest rated scripted drama that they ever had. And then they had a shuffling at the top of their executives, like, who are pretty much all of them gone now, like that. But they cut us loose, like, and we were fortunate enough that Netflix grabbed us right up. And that was the point in time when everybody, you know, nobody really knew much about Netflix at that point. It was kind of like, really? Computer streaming? Who's going to watch TV on their computer? And all of a sudden, all the TVs started coming out, you know, as smart TVs, you know, and now, you know, Netflix is one of the hottest studios in town.
Well, I was online yesterday and noticed that even Amazon, they must be selling the DVD packets or something.
You know? Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And all of these streaming companies are coming up fast like that because people are watching them. Like
sure.
That. So they have the funding and the amount of economic muscle, you know, in Hollywood like to get things done. And
well, who knows? Somebody may view a couple of your shows and get inspired to read the books.
Hey, you know, that's what I count on. Like, I got a little five-second blip right there at the beginning of every episode that says, based on the novels by Craig Johnson. And there's actually one instance I can tell you about that'll like probably illustrate that better than anything else. It was one where I was in a little cafe in Red Lodge, Montana, and happened to be wearing my Absaroka County Sheriff's Department ball cap. And the woman behind the counter said, "Where'd you get that hat?" And I said, "Well, you know, I thought, oh, she thinks I'm a real deputy. I'm going to have to chase somebody because they dined and ditched in this cafe in Red Lodge." And I said, "Well, it's not a real county." And she goes, "The hell it's not. It's Walt Longmire's county." So I had to explain to her that I was Craig Johnson and that I wrote the books. And she'd never heard either one. So it's it can sometimes be frustrating like that because, I mean, you know, Hollywood is always going to have a much wider reach than traditional publishing like that. But, you know, boy, I've benefited over the last 6 years from all the wonderful things they've done.
Were you inspired at all by some of the others through the years that have written Western novels?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, some of the ones that immediately come to mind are Tony Hillerman, who was actually a good friend, before he passed away. I was fortunate enough to have a short story that won the Cowboys and Indians magazine Tony Hillerman Award called Old Indian Trick. And I got to know Tony pretty well I mean, there's some really magnificent, Western writers out there that, have had an incredible amount of an effect on me. I mentioned Wallace Stegner earlier. There's so many others. Walter Van Tilburg, Clark, Jack Schaefer, Dorothy Johnson, some of these golden era Western writers that most people, a lot of them don't even know about anymore. And for me, they really do, they cut their chops and they're just as good as any kind of literary fiction that you could possibly pick up. Of course, the difficulty is they've been relegated to the ghetto of Western literature and there are a certain number of people that won't pick up a book if it's got a cowboy hat on it. So
I'm for those of you that are trying to look through your radios, I just handed Craig the other book, An Obvious Fact, and I have it marked there. Whether you read it in the book or you watch it on television, there seems to be some sort of tension between Deputy Vic and Walt. And I've had a number of people say, make sure you ask him about that. So there's a passage there. If you can see where I've got it marked, give it a shot.
I can. I'll try. This is going to be a dry reading here, but I'll do my best. I pointed the way. She turned the corner, and I felt the car go slightly airborne as we went over some railroad tracks. I like driving fast. I like doing most things fast. She gave me a side glance. Most things, that is. I indicated a right-hand turn, and she flat-tracked the Dodge around another corner, expertly correcting the drift. Rocketing into the hospital parking lot, she slipped into a diagonal spot and cut the engine. So, you miss me? I still had both hands braced against the dash. Can I open my eyes now? Pussy. Yeah, she's a tough character it was difficult because when they did it on the television show, they kind of had to tone her down a lot, and but it was very interesting for me because she's a very, very strong character. One of the things I thought about whenever I was coming up with the basic design of this world, Absaroka County and these characters, I knew that the books were going to be written in first person, and so Walt was going to be the voice of the books, and so there was going to be a really strong masculine kind of aspect to the books, and so I knew the way that I had to balance that was I had to have really, really strong female characters, and they basically surround Walt is what they do, whether it's Ruby, whether it's Dorothy, whether it's Vic, whether it's Katie, his daughter, all of them they kind of keep him in line to a certain extent. And then I had a lot of people who told me you can have sexual tension in your books, but you can't have anything happen for 17 or 18 books. And my immediate response to that was, what kind of women are you dating that would wait 17 or 18 years for something to happen?
Right. So I've got to ask you this, because there have been a number of writers down through the last 15, 20 years that I've noticed more particularly that have a stable of researchers and assistant writers and so on and so forth in cranking out a number of books. How big is your stable?
You're looking at it. Like, kind of hard to have a staff in U Cross, Wyoming, population 25. I got to be honest with you. I think you're cheating yourself. You know, first of all, I think, you know, and especially in the research aspect of the books, you know, the problem that I would have in having anybody else doing the research in my books would be that I'm not always sure what it is I'm looking for. You know, there's always the ancillary information that you come up with, you know, when you're pursuing something. I mean, there are stories that you run onto that are just too good to pass up. I mean, I'm doing research on a book, you know, that I'm writing, you know, now, and you know, and was doing a little bit of research on Ambrose Bierce, like that, who disappeared into Mexico during the, you know, the Mexican Revolution, like that. And there was a story that Ambrose Bierce told about the attack on Harper's Ferry. He was a Union soldier at that period in time, like that. And the Teamsters actually abandoned their mules, like that. And the mules, getting confused by the cannon fire, actually turned and ran back into the Confederate attack and broke it up. And Ambrose Bierce actually wrote a memo trying to get them. Moved up to being horses, like that. Right. He thought they should be promoted to being horses because they were the ones that actually broke the attack, like that. Well, I never would have found that information out if I hadn't been, you know, reading that book myself, like, yeah. So I think that that's a lot of it. And then, you know, having somebody else help you write the books or something. I have you ever read a book written by two authors that was any good?
There's only one.
Which one?
Pillars of the Church.
Oh, okay. Okay.
But it was written a number of years ago, and I can't remember his name, Englishman. He went on, in I think the introduction of his book about the number of people that assisted him, you know, and the researchers and all that. But it was a well written book.
And I can understand if you're doing a period historical or something like that, you might need a staff of sorts. But, you know, for me, I live in Wyoming. I wake up in Wyoming, and it's important to me. I would think I was, you know, cheating myself if I wasn't doing all of that myself, to a great extent. You know, and then as far as the writing is concerned, I'm a dictator. I like writing my books my way, how I want to write them.
Well, that's the way it should be.
Yeah, I think that.
No, I think that if you're developing a character, you've got to develop it the way you see it.
A singularity of vision, I guess. Yeah, you know, it's definitely one of the cases where, you know, too many cooks spoil the broth.
Yeah. I've handed you back an obvious fact here, and you can see where I have it marked.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. First, give us a real quick overview of what an obvious fact is about. And then this has to do with character development. Whether this character comes back in another one of your books or not, but it would be an interesting sort of scenario.
Well, I'm a big one for lampooning popular culture an awful lot of the time, like that. And this one actually takes place in a little town called Hewlett, up in the northeast corner of Wyoming, up in Crook County. And what happens is, you know, it's a little town of about 300 people with a police force of one. And that's actually pretty good odds, you know, with the crime rates that we have, you know, in the High Plains, 300, you know, persons per police officer. The only problem being that it's right next to the first national monument of the United States, Devil's Tower. And the little town across the border over in South Dakota is a little town called Sturgis.
Heard of it.
And I think it was like about 2 years ago, they had their 75th anniversary and had over 1 million bikers there. Like that. And in this particular novel, what happens is there's a young biker who gets run off the road and they can't quite figure out, you know, how or why or any of that, like that. And so one of the police officers happened to be working there, like that, calls Walt up and says, why don't you guys come on over and have a look at this and see what kind of information you guys can glean from this. It's kind of Walt for hire, I guess, at this point.
Okay, read that little section there.
She relaxed and punched his shoulder, but withdrew her hand and wiped it on her jeans, just now realizing his jersey was toxic and torn and had blood on it. There's Billy the, with a capital E, Kiddo. That's the only person I ever saw with him. Billy the Kiddo? No, Billy the, with a capital E. You've never heard of him? He's got his own TV show, Billy the Kiddo's Chopper Off. It was huge till he punched some producer and they canceled it. Word is that he's negotiating with another cable network and they're going to have another series based on him. She shrugged. At least that's what they say. He's originally from here and has a custom motorcycle place just over down the street called The Chop Shop. The Chop Shop. I shook my head. Do you have an address? Oh, you can't miss it. She glanced at Henry again. You tell B-Way I said to text me, okay?
It's a lot of fun creating those characters and developing them, I'm sure. But a friend of mine, the same one that you signed the book for, she wanted to know if you actually work from an outline or do you go helter-skelter?
I got to admit, and I'll summon up his name again. You know, Tony Hillerman used to just fly by the seat of his pants. I talked to him about it one time, and he said, I just start it and see where it goes. Like, and I had to tell him, I said, you know what, that just scares the living daylights out of me. There's no way I would ever sit down and try and write a book like that. That would be like me and you running out here and jumping in my truck and saying, let's go to Jacksonville, Florida, but let's not take a map. I would say, why don't we take a map? Even if we don't use it, let's take it with us. Like, but you know, for me, I guess what I tend to refer to what I write is socially responsible, you know, crime fiction, in the sense that I'm not really looking to just, you know, stack up bodies like cordwood. I'm looking to say something. And, you know, one of the biggest statements that you make in a whodunit is who did it.
Right.
And so for me, it's very important that I have all of those, you know, tent stakes, you know, pounded in, you know, before
you go back
to
those permutations.
I do like that. And so I do. I start off with a really, really strong outline that has, you know, all the information that I need to write this book, because it guards against a couple of other things whenever I'm talking to writing students. I mean, the first one being that, you know, it guards against writer's block, you know, because all writer's block really is just not knowing what happens next. And if you've got an outline, you always know what's happening next. The other thing that it can help with is that major bugaboo that I see with a lot of young authors starting out, which is pacing. It's very difficult to teach pacing like that, and you never really are sure of the pacing of your book unless you're looking at the structure of it. And the only way you can look at that structure before you actually write the novel and invest 300 to 400 pages in it is by having an outline. Okay, so I think that, you know, it's a kind of essential aspect of the whole process, certainly for me, to have that outline and be able to work with it.
Okay, Craig, we're going to take one more break. And when we return, we've got just a few questions, and then we'll let you head off to some other kind of pasture.
Well, I'm going to be at Powell's. I guess I want to be one of the pastures here, like, hopefully tonight.
All right. We'll be right back. Here is Lucinda Williams.
Between your teeth.
Here you go, World Without Tears, Lucinda Williams, one of my favorites.
Really great tastes in music on this show, I have to tell you.
Yeah, well, I'm the music director,
uh-huh.
And I'm the program director of this particular show that we're doing right now.
Uh-huh.
So I kind of like pays my money and takes my choice.
There we go.
Do you have much say in how the series develops on TV?
I'm an executive creative consultant on the television show. And of course, what that means is I know where the porta potties are on set, like that. But they've been really pretty wonderful about having me involved. I think in an essential way, like it's a lot easier for them, you know, because they're down in Los Angeles, like, and the television show is actually filmed in New Mexico. And so whenever they have questions about sheriffing the Northern Cheyenne, Wyoming, the High Plains, and all that, it's a lot easier for them to just call me up and ask me those questions than it is to try and track it down in other sources, like. Because I'd already written about 7 of the books before Warner Brothers got in touch, and so I was pretty easy as far as that was concerned.
Right, right. It's got to be fun too. I mean, it's about. I guess it's a lot to sit around and wait too, but
it is. I mean, if you're not like essentially involved, you know, with what's going on, you know, in the filming, it can kind of be a little bit, you know, boring. But you know, as a general rule, though, like it's kind of interesting to see what someone does, you know, with your work, you know, with your characters, and see where they go, like that. Because you know, with the books, you know, it's a singular vision, as we discussed earlier,
right.
Like that. But you know, with television, with Hollywood, you know, I mean, it's a communal effort, like that. You know, you've got the producers, you've got the directors, you've got the actors, you've got the writers, you've got all of these people that are essentially involved with this, you know, and all of them, you know, have a say, you know, in how it is that it's done. And, you know, for me, it's interesting to see how that kind of communal effort comes across.
Are you working on another Sheriff Walt?
You bet I am. Like that. We've got our 6th season of Longmire that's coming up, you know, on Netflix here at the end of September, beginning of October. I'm not quite sure where. But, the new book, The Western Star, is out. Like that, and I'm already pretty much finished with the book for next year, which is The Depth of Winter.
Mm, okay. Well, the one thing about Wyoming that probably wouldn't appeal to me would be the winters.
Yeah, I can.
I left Chicago, I wouldn't have to.
We were down in Southern California out there in the desert doing an event at a library out there in Rancho Mirage. Like it was 113 degrees, like when we walked out of the library. And I told them, I said, I don't think I could handle this. And they looked at me and they said, well, we don't think we could handle that 40 degree below zero winters that you guys have in Wyoming. And I was like, yeah, it can be a little challenging sometimes.
A lot of truth to that, let me tell you. Well, listen, we're about ready to wind things up here. I want you to know that hopefully you might be able to come back this way next year. That next year in 2018, KBOO is going to celebrate 50 years being on the air.
Oh, how wonderful.
And so we're looking forward to big things than that.
I hope to be here.
It's been fun, and thank you very much for being here.
My pleasure, Dan. Thank you.
You bet. That's Between the Covers for today.
Well, that'll do it for today. Thank you very much to Craig Johnson, author of the Walt Longmire series of mystery books, right here on Between the Covers. We've got a little bit of music time scheduled for you, so we're going to start off with Herbie Hancock and end up with John Coltrane, right here on KBOO and Between the Covers. Well, that's going to do it for today. A little bit of Herbie Hancock and doing Circle, an old Miles Davis tune, and then ending up with John Coltrane, Lazy Bird. That's Between the Covers for today. I'm Dan Johnson. Thanks for listening.
The last 6 weeks have seen an unprecedented number of climate change-related disasters, from multiple hurricanes slamming the Caribbean and the U.S. South to earthquakes in Mexico. Anarchists, anti-fascists, and anti-capitalists have been at the forefront of the disaster relief efforts. Tune in this Friday at 11 a.m. for Mutual Aid Disaster Relief, a special program focusing on Houston, Mexico, and Puerto Rico. I'll speak with Nisi X of the Black Women's Defense League in Texas, as well as anarchist organizer Scott Crow and activists organizing to send aid to Puerto Rico and Mexico.
People put aside their politics. They put aside what they think it should be, because when a disaster opens up us, our hearts, our emergency hearts to humanity, it actually shows who we really are.
That's this Friday from 11 a.m. to noon on KBOO.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM.